From WBUR Boston, this is Here and Now, a daily digest of news and culture.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a conversation with an American reporter in Cuba who's been told by the Cuban government he can no longer be an American reporter in Cuba. But first, tonight, Republican White House hopefuls Rudy Giuliani and Mitt Romney will try to clarify their stance on abortion at the second GOP candidates debate in South Carolina. And they'll likely be asked about a move in that state to couple ultrasounds with abortions. Today, state senators are expected to take up a bill requiring that doctors offer for all women seeking abortion in South Carolina, the chance to view an ultrasound image of the fetus. 10 other states have similar laws. The South Carolina Senate proposal is controversial, but it's a step back from a bill that the South Carolina House recently approved, which doesn't give women a choice. It mandates that they view an ultrasound image before an abortion. Well, we want to get a primer on a topic that no doubt will be raised tonight. Reporter Patrick Johnson writes about so-called witness-to-the-womb laws for today's Christian Science Monitor. Patrick, put this in perspective nationally. How many ultrasound bills and laws are there?
Well, there's 10 that are actually law today, and but this year alone there was 22 more pieces of legislation introduced in 15 other states that have yet to be acted upon, including South Carolina, which they look to be taken up this week.
What specifically does the bill in the South Carolina Senate require?
It basically asks abortion providers to offer an ultrasound to a woman considering an abortion, which in most cases is not done. But the House passed a bill that was much more strict, like you said, actually require women to view an ultrasound of the fetus before having an abortion.
Do any other states have a bill that strict?
No.
So South Carolina would be the first. If the legislature passes two different bills, what happens next?
They'll have to come up with some kind of compromise if it's to go forward. Governor Mark Sanford has already said he'll sign the House version of the bill, but the Senate heard testimony that the House didn't, which came from the Attorney General basically saying that it's unconstitutional to force someone to view an ultrasound or anything against their will. So that was a big point, I think, in the Senate coming up with a softer version of the bill.
Right. Not requiring a woman to view the ultrasound, but requiring doctors to make an ultrasound available. What are proponents and critics saying?
Well, proponents simply say it's medical information that's valuable to a woman making the decision, and basically saying that the more information a woman has, the better a decision she's going to make. Critics, of course, say that women have already made a decision by the time that they actually end up at an abortion clinic, and that this is merely a way to guilt women into perhaps not doing something that they've already decided to do.
Right. You have spoken to two women, one who viewed the ultrasound and made the decision not to have her abortion, one who viewed an ultrasound and decided to have her abortion. What did they each say to you?
Well, it was really interesting, in fact, and some of that came from a testimony directly to the Senate subcommittee as well, but the woman who did decide to have an abortion said that she felt no emotional connection when she actually saw the ultrasound. She said she described it as an itty-bitty smudge, but even though she had that reaction, she felt it was completely unnecessary to add more to this already difficult decision for no apparent medical reason, at least as far as obstetricians, are concerned. But the woman I talked to who had her baby and had it adopted said that for her it was a healing process to really recognize the life and the humanity of the fetus. She saw it in a bit of a spiritual light and as a way to get over the prospect of having to have an abortion. Mm.
We're reading an editorial in The Herald, which is out of Rock Hill, South Carolina, and they ask the question, why is any bill even necessary, given that ultrasounds are already offered? A woman already has the right to ask to see an ultrasound prior to her abortion without a doctor being mandated to tell her she has that choice.
Right. I think, of course, there's political underpinnings to all this, and South Carolina is already probably the most restrictive state in the country when it comes to abortion. So there's a very, very strong pro-life movement in the legislature, and the Senate only has one woman, female member, and she's actually retiring. She actually sat on the Medical Affairs Subcommittee that pushed this bill through on the Senate side.
Patrick Johnson, staff writer for the Christian Science Monitor, on two bills actually that are being considered in South Carolina, one from the House, one from the Senate there. One would require a woman to see an ultrasound of her fetus prior to an abortion. Another would require a doctor to tell her she has that choice. And both bills are probably going to make their way into the Republican debate tonight. Patrick Johnson, thank you.
Thank you.
Life in Cuba after Fidel Castro is gone. That transition will be a big story, the biggest in recent history there, and Gary Marks won't be covering it. Gary's been on the island 5 years. He's a veteran correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. But the Cuban government yanked his press credentials and asked him to leave the island. The government also barred two other veteran foreign correspondents from reporting in Cuba. This happened after Fidel Castro became ill last summer and his brother Raul assumed power. But is it an indication of life in Cuba when Castro is truly gone? Well, we want to get a view from Havana from Gary Marks. To the extent that he can, the government has put pretty strict restrictions on him, but has allowed him to stay in Cuba until his visa expires next month so his two children can finish the school year there. So, Gary, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
What happened? What did Cuban officials say to you?
Well, they basically, you know, all our press credentials of the foreign correspondents here had expired, and so there was a there's a sort of an annual review, and they sent out a list of the dates and times that all the foreign correspondents were going to have their credentials renewed, and my name, along with several other correspondents, were not on that list. This occurred, I think, in February, and so I knew something was up, and then over a series of meetings, basically, with Cuban press and foreign ministry officials, I learned that they were not going to renew my press credentials because they said my stories were too negative, and they basically gave me 90 days to leave the island.
What was the tone of the conversation?
You know, it was actually very friendly. I mean, the Cubans basically said, this is business. This isn't personal, and our image is very important to us overseas, and we feel like your stories are too negative, and we can do better with somebody else.
Very frank, actually. Well, what is your speculation as to why? I mean, your reporting was once praised by Fidel Castro himself, who, by the way, in praising an article of yours, he also realized your name was Marx and seemed to like that as well. I mean, do you remember that?
Of course I do. I mean, it occurred a couple years ago when Fidel got on national TV and was sort of reading the foreign press coverage and praised one of my stories, read the whole thing, and then sort of flipped back through the page to see who wrote it. And then he sort of stopped at my last name, Marx, and said, you know, wow, compadre, and this reporter deserves even more respect. I mean, obviously, I brought that up in the meetings, and I said, listen, you know, I've been doing this job for 25 years. You know, I'm not going to change the way I work. You know, as you make this decision, you should realize that I've done many other stories, including investigative stories of President Bush's financing, the government's financing of dissident groups here, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, they were pretty firm. It was clear to me that the officials I met at the press center, at the foreign ministry, they weren't the ones who really made this decision. The decision was made much higher up.
Some have suggested, and The Nation magazine writes about your situation, and some other reporters have suggested that maybe this was sort of a shot across the bow, just a signal to other correspondents that as this big story heats up, they better get in line.
It's hard for me to speculate because the Cuban government didn't say directly why they threw me out, other than my stories were negative and that they feel like they can do better with somebody else and their foreign image is really important. But clearly, I think that it is a shot across the bow. They're basically telling correspondents who are here and correspondents who want to come in, listen, you better be careful. If you want to be here for this big story, you better be careful what you write. And so that's what I believe it is. Again, the Cuban government has never told me that. They aren't transparent, so it's hard to read their mind. But that's what I believe was the motivation behind this.
You've written articles critical of both the U.S. government's actions in Cuba and the Cuban government. One of the things you wrote about, according to the Nation article, is an elaborate effort to smuggle into Cuba DVD recordings of pro-U.S. television shows when, in fact, there are very few DVD players on the island. But what might you have written critical of the Cuban government?
You know, I don't know. It's hard because I asked them specifically what article may have upset them. But I just write it as I see it. Basically, I've written a number of stories over the last couple years that I just felt, you know, told the story of Cubans. I've been here a long time. It's a very difficult place to write about. It's a very hard place to come in and parachute as a reporter and really figure out what's going on, because there's a lot of fear on the island. You need to win people's trust. You need to get them inside their houses talking about what they really think. And I feel like I've made an effort to do that. I feel like over 5 years I've been able to do that. And I feel like the Cuban government just didn't like what those people were saying. It wasn't about me, what I was saying. It was about what Cubans I interviewed were saying.
Well, and what is that? What is the story of Cuba now?
Well, I mean, I feel, for example, I wrote a story about the December 2nd anniversary of the 50th founding of the Cuban Armed Forces. And I just wrote a story basically saying, listen, they're going to have this huge parade. They're going to trot out these, 20 or 30-year-old Soviet-made weapons. But most Cubans really weren't that interested in the parade. They're more interested about what is going to happen here on the island. How is their situation going to improve economically? What is the relationship going to be like with the United States? They're interested in these very, very important and fundamental issues in their lives. They're not interested in seeing 30-year-old Soviet weapons trotted out in the plaza of the revolution. The Cubans didn't say they were upset at that story, but I believe that was one of the stories they were upset about.
Well, Gary Marks, at least you're not in jail. We're reminded that in 2003 there was a crackdown on domestic reporters, and several of them, even dissidents or intellectuals who weren't necessarily reporting but writing, newsletters, were imprisoned with sentences up to 27 years. Again, we're reading this in The Nation. So it's a reminder, as another reporter says, this government plays hardball. Do you think one of the reasons that you and other longtime correspondents are being removed is because you have these contacts with the Cuban people and new reporters coming in to cover this transition, this upcoming transition of power, won't really, really get the pulse of the people?
Yeah, again, that's speculation, but I think that absolutely is part of it. The Cubans are very sophisticated. They know this is a very sensitive time for them. They look at the Bush administration and they see threats and they see a tightening of the economic embargo. In their view, public opinion in the United States is very important. They would rather have some correspondents fly in here who don't really know Cuba, and there are some terrific correspondents who fly in here when they're allowed, when they're given a visa, but they would prefer people who fly in here or people who are living here and who have a stake in Cuba to report the story rather than people who know Cuba, I think, really well and who are going to write with an independent voice. I just think that's my view. Again, the Cubans have never told me that, but I feel strongly that that's what's happening here.
That's Gary Marks, a foreign correspondent for the Chicago Tribune based in Cuba, where the government yanked his press credentials. He's speaking to us anyway. When we come back, we'll ask Gary about some of his favorite stories. One was about a catcher's mitt, of all things. And later in the show, what vitamins did you take today? It might be those you throw away after you hear the latest research. We'll have that for you. And also, the war in Iraq hits home for a frequent guest here on Here and Now. That's later as well. Back after a quick break. Here and Now. We're back with more from veteran Chicago Tribune correspondent Gary Marks. He's been based in Cuba for the past 5 years. The Cuban government recently told him he'd have to leave the island next month, and he's no longer allowed to report from there. So, Gary, you really can't talk much about politics, but looking back at the 5 years you've been on the island, can you tell us some of the favorite stories you've covered?
Oh, boy. Mm-hmm. That's a hard one. I mean, maybe the story of a teenage baseball player who lost his glove. And the glove had been given to him by his father, who had immigrated to Miami. And the boy absolutely cherished this glove. It was a catcher's mitt. And when he lost it, it was stolen at a baseball field. His grandmother, who essentially is taking care of this boy, rode on her bike for miles and miles and talked to dozens of people just to get this glove back. And I think it showed to me not only the resilience of Cubans, the poverty of Cubans, and the heartbreak of immigration and families being split, but also the Cubans' great love of baseball. It's stories like that that I really cherish, stories that say a lot about this country, but through just a very simple thing, like a baseball glove going missing.
Did he find it?
He absolutely did find it. I think another one of the stories that I really enjoyed doing was going into a neighborhood in which, in the middle of the night, some dissidents had distributed leaflets with one of President Bush's speeches talking about freedom for Cuba. And I went out there in the early morning hours. I had found out about it and basically just absolutely talked to people in the neighborhood about what their reaction is. I mean, you can imagine in Cuba what it would be like if you, opened your door one day and found President Bush smiling at you with his, words about freedom for Cuba. Many people reacted with horror and with shock, but also some people reacted with acceptance. They felt like it was really good that they were finally getting a word from an outside source in terms of information. I mean, I think that kind of describes Cuba. I mean, there are people on all sides here. And so I think the complexity and the diversity of the response was what was so interesting.
I'm trying to flip it around and think of what it would be like to open my door and have a letter from Fidel Castro. But
I don't think it would be a big deal. I mean, that's the thing. In the United States, there's just a wide diversity, a wide range of opinion, whereas in Cuba, they basically have four television stations and newspapers that basically toe the party line. So to wake up and see, public enemy number one staring at you on your front lawn in the morning is something that was just quite a shock for a lot of Cubans.
Is there no satellites, nothing, nobody's pulling in CNN?
There's pirated satellite primarily in Havana. But for the most part, for most Cubans, the only access to information that they've got are Cuban state-run television and Cuban newspapers. And like I said, they are total mouthpieces of the Cuban government.
What about the Internet?
No, Internet is tightly controlled here. Most Cubans don't have computers in their houses. I mean, it's illegal. You need to get government permission to buy a computer. So not only do people not have computers, most Cubans don't have any access to the Internet.
Did you ever interview Fidel Castro?
Not one-on-one. I've grabbed him at conferences and things like that, but, I never got to interview him one-on-one.
What would be the one thing you'd want to ask him if you could?
Boy, I would ask him probably about his, his future vision for the island and his legacy. Again, I can't talk about Cuban politically because the Cubans have made it clear that would get tossed from the country immediately. But, I think I would ask about, what he views his legacy as, and does he think this system can survive without him? By all indications, the system is going to survive and there is going to be continuity.
Well, Gary Marks, before we let you go, how about a few questions on a personal level? How do you feel about Cuba?
You know what? I love this country. I really do. I think the people are amazing. Unbelievable talent here, unbelievable resilience under often incredible hardships. I'm very sad to be leaving Cuba under these circumstances, and also feel like it's been a great honor to live in the country and report on it for 5 years. It's very bittersweet for me.
What's it like to be a reporter in a place where you can't report? What are you doing?
Well, I just got back from Haiti. And Colombia, I'm covering the other countries that I normally cover. I mean, it's obviously incredibly frustrating. I mean, there's all these observations I have, and it's unbelievably frustrating. I mean, I literally cannot go outside with a notebook in my pocket because if the Cuban government has made it clear, if they catch me reporting or writing about Cuba, I'm going to get tossed immediately. So the short answer is it's unbelievably frustrating. And I can't really say much more than that, but obviously it's a country I've grown to love and understand, I believe, and it's difficult.
Gary Marks, a foreign correspondent based in Cuba without any press credentials. Gary Marks, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks, Robin. It was a pleasure.
And this note. Some of you may know the name Andrew Bacevich. The Boston University professor and retired Army Lieutenant Colonel is a veteran of the Vietnam and Gulf Wars, a former teacher at West Point and Johns Hopkins, a military analyst and longtime critic of the war in Iraq, and you may have heard his frequent visits to Here and Now. You did not hear us talk about his son, also named Andrew Bacevich, because his father specifically asked us not to. The younger Andrew Bacevich wanted to walk in his dad's big footsteps. He joined the military and was stationed in Iraq last October. His father didn't want that mentioned because he said it would be an invasion of his son's privacy and would distract from the father's message. That message, sent before the war began in 2003, before his son enlisted in the Army in 2004, was that the invasion of Iraq was a mistake. For those who say no voices were raised in protest, here is Professor Basevich writing in the Los Angeles Times in March of 2003. If, as seems probable, the effort encounters greater resistance than its architects imagine, our way of life may find itself tested in wars that will make the Vietnam War look like a mere blip in American history. Now, Professor Basevich is being tested. His son Andy was killed in Iraq on Sunday. Reports say he stopped a suspicious vehicle and was killed when the driver detonated a suicide bomb. No doubt, First Lieutenant Andrew Basevich, in stopping that bomber, saved many other lives. No doubt his dad, retired Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Basevich, tried to do the same with his warnings years ago. Percent of Americans say they take multivitamins or minerals in an attempt to stay healthy or stave off heart disease, cancer, and other illnesses. In fact, Americans spend about $23 billion a year on dietary supplements. But what does the latest research say about how effective they are? Well, get your wastebasket ready, because here to answer that question is syndicated health columnist Judy Foreman, who joins us frequently on Here and Now to talk things health. And in this case, you also made a confessional in your column, did you not?
I did. I used to really believe in vitamins, and now I'm afraid I have lost the faith.
Yeah, there's a lot that went from your medicine cabinet into the wastebasket. But let's tick through. Let's go through some of the items in your column, the fading allure of vitamins. It all started when you tossed out beta-carotene.
Yeah, that started a long time ago, like 13 years ago. There was a big study from Finland, and it was all in men, and it was in smokers, like 29,000 of them. And it actually showed that with beta-carotene, they had a higher death rate from lung cancer than without beta-carotene. Huh. And then there was another study a couple of years later in this country showing the same thing. So clearly, even though I wasn't a smoker and I didn't have lung cancer, I thought, okay, no more beta-carotene.
Now, what did you hope that beta-carotene would do for you?
I wasn't sure. I thought it was a general cancer preventer. I mean, that's what mm-hmm. the news of the time was suggesting. But it turned out not to be true.
At least in those two studies.
Yeah.
And by the way, what do the makers of beta-carotene and some of these other vitamins say? They tend to point to other studies that say it does work.
Yeah, there are studies all over the place, and there's some really good people in the field who do get money from the vitamin manufacturers who sort of defend these things. So it makes it really hard to know who to believe, because right. there's good researchers who do get money and good researchers who don't get money from the manufacturers.
Right. So you tried to look at as many studies as you could. Tell us what you found out about vitamin E.
All right. This was a heartbreaker. I really, really wanted to believe in vitamin E. And I kept taking it for a long time.
To do what?
Cancer, heart disease. I mean, the mm-hmm. usual basic things. But then there was a study in 2004 from Johns Hopkins that showed that people who were taking more than 400 IUs, that's international units, a day, and that was the standard dose that everybody mm-hmm. was taking, actually had a higher death rate than people who weren't taking that. And that's deaths from all causes, so it's not just cancer or just heart disease. That was kind of discouraging. And then there was the Women's Health Study, and they studied 40,000 women, healthy women, and they found no benefit for vitamin E for heart disease or cancer.
Okay.
And that's pretty disappointing.
How about echinacea and vitamin C? People use these to stave off colds.
Tossing out echinacea was really hard. In fact, I think I still have a bottle I haven't totally parted with.
Because you're very honest. You write that you felt that it worked, but maybe that's teaching you something about the placebo effect.
Yes. You know, if you believe you can fight that cold with echinacea, you want to fight that cold. But the studies where they do a control thing and give people fake echinacea and real echinacea show it really doesn't work. There was a big study in 2005 in the New England Journal. And once you don't believe it anymore, the placebo effect stops working for you.
It doesn't work. And vitamin C.
Oh, vitamin C. Everybody wants to believe in vitamin C ever since Linus Pauling. And the data are just so mixed. You know, it just doesn't seem to clearly do what everybody wants, fighting colds, fighting cancer. And by the way, I should say a lot of people are on chemotherapy for cancer, and many of them take mega doses of vitamin C. And it's really... it's a mixed bag. If that's your situation, you should check with your doctor, because vitamin C is an antioxidant, but some of the cancer drugs work by creating free radicals that you normally wouldn't want, but you would want to fight cancer. So be careful with the antioxidant vitamins if you're also on chemo.
By the way, we're not saying that vitamin C or vitamin E or any of these vitamins aren't good for you, but what, you're supposed to get them through your food or something.
Right. Yeah. And, of course, the reason I have been in love with vitamins is that, you know, like many other people, I find it really hard to eat a really good diet every day. I mean, I do pretty well, but, you know, we don't eat the way we're supposed to. So we try to compensate with vitamins.
Okay. What about multivitamins?
Oh, that's another tough one. There was a big conference at the National Institutes of Health, and they wrote about it in 2006, and they couldn't come to a conclusion. They couldn't find whether there was a clear benefit or harm to multivitamins. And that's enough to give you pause, but even more of a worry is that there's this group called Consumer Lab, which issued a report in January, and they actually just went to the store, bought a bunch of multivitamins and tested them, and found that 52%, so that's more than half, either were contaminated with lead or didn't disintegrate properly in the stomach or didn't have the amount of ingredients that the label said they were supposed to have. So whether or not the vitamins are actually good for you is a question, and then whether you're getting what the label says is another question, and you may be doing harm if it has lead.
And by the way, we're going to hook you up to Judy's column so you can see the names of the different multivitamins and see what these different studies found about them. Well, speaking of multivitamins, what about kids' multivitamins?
Yeah, that's really a concern, obviously, for people with young children. There was a product called Yummy Bears, and it flunked the Consumer Lab test because it had too much vitamin A, and it's long been known that vitamin A in high doses can be toxic.
And by the way, what does Yummy Bears say about that finding?
Well, they deny that. They say there's no basis for that allegation.
Well, you have some vitamins that are still on your counter, and you have a caveat about the ones that you've spoken negatively of, and it has to do with macular degeneration?
Yeah, if you are at risk for adult macular degeneration, and that's really common, so many people are at risk, there is some evidence from the National Eye Institute, and you can go on the web and check out the study, that taking vitamin C, vitamin E, beta carotene, and zinc may help slow the progression of macular degeneration. So if that's your situation, you should talk to your eye doctor and take it. But there was also a recent study showing that the beta carotene part of that may not be adding anything to it. So it may be just the vitamin C, vitamin E, and zinc.
So you have a lot more time and money on your hands now that you've chucked everything out. What is it that you still use?
Okay, I still believe, and you know, tune in next year for the latest, but omega-3 oil, that has not been tarnished in my mind by any studies. You can get them from fish oils, and you can get them from flaxseed. And by the way, this Consumer Lab testing found, to my great relief, that the fish oil capsules that you take do not have PCBs, do not have mercury, so they're actually supposedly safe. And so far, I believe that.
And what are you taking them for?
Those are for general cardiovascular health, and they help fight heart arrhythmias, you know, rhythm dysfunctions.
Mm-hmm. And?
I'm still high on vitamin D. And by the way, not many people know this, but they should. Vitamin D3 is the one you should be taking, not D2.
Why's that?
It's just better absorbed and works better to help prevent cancer and strengthen your bones.
And we also take vitamin D to process calcium?
Calcium is another one that's on the maybe list. I still think it's a good thing, but there was a study last week that suggested that for broken bones, there may be a bigger genetic component than we used to think, and therefore it's not quite as clear how much good calcium is going to do.
Hmm. You've cut, like, what, a half hour out of your morning?
It didn't take me that long.
And what do you say, just a better diet? to replace these?
Better diet, vitamins? And personally, I think if there's a magic bullet, it is exercise. So I would take the money that you save from the vitamins and buy a pair of running shoes and get out there and run.
Judy Foreman, nationally syndicated health columnist, a regular contributor to Here and Now. To read her column on the vitamins she tossed, go to our website, here-now.org. And as always, Judy, you recommend people talk to their own doctors.
Yes, of course.
Make their mind up. Judy, thanks.
Sure.
Well, still to come, Studio 360's Kurt Anderson as novelist. You're listening to Here and Now. It seems everything in the Middle East becomes political eventually, even children's television. Last week, officials at the television station run by the militant Palestinian group Hamas bowed to international pressure and promised to suspend a children's show that featured a Mickey Mouse character calling for international jihad. Well, there will be an alternative for kids. After a 10-year absence, Sesame Street returns to Palestinian TV today. The Israeli version of the popular children's show returned to the tube in December. As Daniel Estrin reports from Jerusalem, the two Sesame Streets are back in the neighborhood to teach more than just the alphabet.
In a Jerusalem kindergarten, Avigail, a 3-year-old Muppet with pink hair, greets children, while the kids jeer at the cantankerous Moshe Ufnik, Israel's Oscar the Grouch, telling him to go back to his trash can. Gary Nell, president of Sesame Workshop, brought the Muppets to class to celebrate the return of Sesame Street to Israeli television with its message of tolerance and respect.
It's really about showing children in everyday life. A Muslim child gets up in the morning, a Jewish child gets up in the morning, brushes his teeth, eats breakfast. And you know what? All of a sudden, that child's saying, you know what? This kid's not very different from me.
That's the idea behind the new season of the Israeli Sesame Street called Rehov Sumsum. Rehov Sumsum ran on Israeli TV from the 1980s up until 10 years ago, when it lost its funding. Now it's back with a group of characters who reflect Israel's diverse population, including its new immigrants. There's Melkamo, an Ethiopian student, Irina, a Russian magic shop owner, and musically inclined Mahbub, the show's first Arab Israeli Muppet. These minorities, which have faced discrimination from mainstream Israelis, are presented as role models. Rehov Sumsum producer Alona Apt doesn't ignore the fact that the average Israeli street isn't as diverse or tolerant as is Sesame Street.
The main goal is to show a different kind of street, to show the children what life can look like. Because we feel the children today growing up in Israel are really living in a very tense time in which people are affected from a very young age, and we wanted to model something else.
Meanwhile, over on Shara Simsim, the Palestinian Sesame Street, a similar effort is underway. That's the voice of Salim, a new character who Palestinian producers hope will serve as a role model for young male viewers. Shara Simsim debuts this week on an independent Palestinian network. Its goal? Empower young Palestinian boys, many of whom experience high levels of frustration in the current climate of poverty and unemployment. In this scene, the show's two Muppet stars, a rooster named Karim and his younger female friend Hanin, look out the window in Salim's fix-it shop as a storm overturns trash bins, damages trees, and destroys their kite.
So they don't know what they're going to do, and they say things have been destroyed forever.
Cairo Arafat is an editor on Shara Simsim.
And then with the help of Salim, they begin to see, well, is there anything we can do to make this situation here better? What they find is that just like we had built Sesame Street in the first place, we can rebuild it and even make it a better place, and that the more we give to our community, the better it gets. A lot of what we try to teach children in preschool, the idea of respect for the self, respect for the other, are things that we've lost as adults.
Sunny day, sleeping up.
Around the time of the Oslo Peace Accords, Sesame Workshop produced a joint Palestinian-Israeli show. Plans for a second season were shelved in 2000 after the outbreak of the Second Intifada. Now, with Sesame Street's guiding model of two streets for two peoples, each production, Palestinian and Israeli, is focusing on bettering its own society.
Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem. To see Palestinian and Israeli Sesame Street Muppets, go to our website, here-now.org. Be careful what you wish for. I've always wanted more people to write about early New York City, the way Dickens did London, thick with details. Well, Kurt Anderson's new novel, Heyday, is thick, and thick with details.
April 27th, 1848, New York City. He looked and listened and smelled more acutely than he ever had before. His preconceptions were already sloughing away as the actual America, bit by vivid bit, began to replace accreted years of wishful speculation. His last look at the old world had been Liverpool's orderly stone wharves. This first glimpse of the new world was all rotting wood and ramshackle sheds, a jumble of painted signs and paper billboards and chalked words and prices on blackboards. Everything and everyone seemed to shout and hawk. The bustle of people and carts and animals seemed greater than in London, wilder and even slightly desperate, but also somehow happier. And strangers looked at him as intently as he looked at each of them, looked him straight in the eye, as no Londoner who wasn't a whore or a lunatic would think of doing.
Heyday transports us to 1848, the year Darwin arrived at his theory of evolution, miners struck gold in California, and Benjamin Knowles, the novel's British protagonist, seemed to be in the middle of all of it, helping to spark a riot in Paris that would topple a monarchy by striking a sergeant with a stuffed penguin before coming to New York City in that scene we just heard. And author Kurt Anderson joins us from WNYC in New York with more. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
I am thankful that you've transported us back to this time, but hoo boy, the detail. You're such a modern guy, you know, one of the founders of Spy Magazine, former editor of New York Magazine, host of Public Radio Studio 360. What transported you to 1848?
Well, I guess that it seems so astoundingly modern to me as I began looking into it. I knew very little about this period. It's a sort of period that in our history, as we're growing up, is glossed over pretty quickly. It wasn't the Civil War. It wasn't the Old West. It wasn't the Revolution. It's kind of this empty place. But as I began reading and plunging into it, it seemed like this secret moment that modern life began.
And we hear all the details from that time. Who holds the patent on the new corpse refrigerator? The angle of a gentleman's collar. Street kids were called bohoys, prostitutes punks. Research, how long did that take you?
I spent about a year and a half doing nothing but research, and it was bliss. You know, there may be a lot of details in the book, and there are, to give a sense of the time, but not nearly as many as I absorbed over that year and a half of research.
Well, let's set the scene. We have Benjamin, the young Englishman we heard in the scene arrive in America, the second son of the Englishman, Sir Archibald Knowles. He's shadowed by Gabriel Drummond. Drummond's brother was killed in that riot in France that toppled the monarchy, and Benjamin was there with a stuffed penguin for reasons we won't go into, but Drummond is determined to avenge the death of his brother.
He holds Ben responsible, yeah.
What do those two characters mean to you, Benjamin and Drummond?
Well, Ben Knowles is a young British man. He's never been to America until April 27th, 1848, but he thinks it's everything that Europe and the old world and England and this class-bound system that he's grown up in isn't. He thinks that people can invent themselves and anything is possible, but he has no idea of the dark sides and the difficult sides and the complexity of the real place until he arrives on these shores. Drummond is the most 19th century character, main character in the book, because he still is ruled by very old-fashioned ideas of duty and honor and the kind of ancient regime where kings were kings and Napoleon was in charge and the order was set. Young Ben Knowles is eager to escape that old world, while Drummond is very much sorry to see the old world go.
And when they get here, Ben in particular, they meet, it's sort of like a reverse Dickens, they meet the artful dodgers of America. Timothy Skaggs, a journalist, photographer, bon vivant, Duff Lucking, sort of a shell-shocked firefighter and pyromaniac, and Duff's sister Polly, who, well, part-time prostitute, a new woman who doesn't need marriage and hopes to be an actress. One of the reasons I love this is that we always go to Dickens for these characters. We had these characters.
Yeah, we think of exactly the Dickensian era and the Victorian era being all about London. Well, as you say, it was here and here in an interesting way. Of course, Dickens wrote two books, one novel about America, and he hated it. He flew back to England as fast as he could because it was just too rambunctious. I mean, New York City in the middle of the 19th century was hyper-energetic, a manic place where things were just being built.
Well, and they make their way, this merry band of characters, cross-country, to what they think is going to be utopia, California, the gold rush. What are you saying about that, about their, you know, their move west?
Well, there are lots of flavors of utopian dream going on at this moment. This riot in Paris, which then becomes a revolution, and then the monarchy is toppled in a couple of days, led to revolutions in several dozen countries in Europe within a few months. And in America, various different kinds of utopia. There was this sudden magical moment of the discovery of gold, but then there were also all these literally utopian communes popping up all across the country. So suddenly people thought, wow, life and man and society are perfectible. I can really, it can be what we'd always dreamed of. I was getting at all of the various versions of utopian yearning that were going on then.
How much fun did you have colliding your fictional characters with real-life characters from the day that you fictionalized? I'm thinking of Walt Whitman, de Tocqueville, Darwin. Ben's family knows Darwin. What are the details that are true that you worked into those characters? For instance, did Charles Darwin really have a problem with flatulence?
Charles Darwin really had a problem with flatulence, and I have never seen it treated comically as I do, but that was definitely part of the great Charles Darwin's life that he dealt with. Part of the fun of historical fiction is, yes, creating your own entirely fictional universe, but trying to fit that as seamlessly as possible into the real world of war and revolutions and the new telegraph and the new railroads, and in the case of Heyday, of Walt Whitman being a 29-year-old guy who'd just been fired and from his job. And so not only was America young, but these people like Karl Marx and Frederick Engels and Charles Darwin was still fairly young, and Walt Whitman, everybody was a young person.
Exactly. Kurt Anderson, what are you saying about us? Was this our heyday?
It was a heyday, maybe the heyday. I don't know of any other moment in American history where the sense of change was so great and the sense of hopefulness was so great. Now, of course, they didn't know in 1848 that they were 13 years away from the greatest, most terrifying, most horrible, tragic event in our history, the Civil War. So even at the heyday, at this time of enormous possibility and hope and excitement, this dark shadow was just ahead. So 1848, 1849, this moment was when American life and modern life began taking the shape that all of us know today.
And that you continue to explore on your radio program, which I think kind of comes full circle. Kurt Anderson's new novel is called Heyday. Kurt, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at Acura.com/RDX.